On to item number four, Conservation and Sustainable Fisheries Plan. This is a briefing. Cindy, welcome.
Good morning. I'm Cindy LaFleur. I'm the Regional Fish Program Manager in Region 5, and with me is Pat Frazier. He's the Region 5 Fish Program Policy Coordinator. I wanted to give you a little bit of introduction of why the two of us are here today to present the Conservation and Sustainable Fisheries Plan. Pat started working on this plan many years ago when he was in my position with the department when he was a program manager. He took another job and went and worked with the recovery board for a few years, and then I took over his position, and then we decided to make it a joint document with WDFW and the recovery board, Lower Columbia Fish Recovery Board. So we worked on it together in that capacity, and then about 6 months ago, Pat came back, made the wise choice, and came back to work for WDFW in Region 5. And so we're working to finish this up with the recovery board, and so that's why we're both here today. And I just want to say, I'm going to let Pat start us off, but in a nutshell, what the Conservation and Sustainable Fisheries Plan is, in my vision, is how we are going to implement your hatchery and fishery reform policy in Region 5. Now, turn it over to Pat.
Thank you, Cindy. Good morning, folks. Appreciate being back with WDFW, and thank you, Cindy, for bringing me back home. I'll move on with the plan here and moving forward. Cindy stole my opening line. This is about how to implement a policy, and a very valuable and important policy that you as a commission adopted and gave us some excellent direction in terms of how we proceed to not only benefit fisheries in the region throughout the state and to benefit the natural populations that live in our important state. So that's implementing the hatchery and fishery reform policy. One of the keys is, as we did this, let's be consistent with the Lower Columbia Fish Recovery Plan. We need to achieve those goals and those outcomes set forth in that recovery plan. This is a tool for us to do this. This is a way for us to help achieve those goals also. What this plan does really is it lays out a specific set of actions, detailed actions, and those detailed actions occur on a population-by-population basis. So when you look at Chapter 7 of this document, you'll see the heart of this document, the heart and soul of this document. You'll see, you can go to the Klamath River Falls Chinook and say, what is WDFW doing to benefit natural populations, that natural population, and support fisheries that depend on the production out of the hatcheries in that basin? And that's what really the essence and soul of this plan is really about. It focuses on all hatchery way of moving forward. It really focuses solely on the hatcheries and harvest. This is how WDFW is telling the rest of the world, we're doing our job. We're stepping up to the plate, and we are achieving the hatchery and harvest goals that we need to do to benefit recovery of listed population and support sustainable productive fisheries. Key to this is going to be, we need help from some partners. Hydro and Harvest have to step up and have to begin to help us. If we don't have them along with us, this plan will do some good things and give some benefits, but it won't achieve the ultimate success that we're all looking for in this region. So what is the long-term? So we have the purpose and goals of this plan, as Cindy talked about, is the purpose is very simple, to implement the hatchery and fishery reform policy. And that's the simple purpose, and that's why we're doing it. What are our goals with this? We want to recover natural origin populations, and we want to recover them to healthy and harvestable levels, as called for in the recovery plan. And we want to support sustainable, productive, sport, commercial, and tribal fisheries throughout the region. And that doesn't include just the Columbia, just a tributary. It includes those ocean fisheries, includes Canadian fisheries that we have agreements with that depend on our production to support their fisheries also. We have some long-term visions we have, And these long-term visions will look familiar if you're involved with the HSRG, because the Hatchery Scientific Review Group also has these same long-term visions. And we thought they were extremely valuable, so we used them in our conservation sustainable fishery plan to guide our actions. The first one is we want habitat of sufficient quantity and quality to support viable natural origin populations. And here's where our partners come in. We can't fix that. We can do a little bit on the lands we own, but at the end of the day, most lands are owned by people other than us, and most habitat and hydro impacts are out of our control. So all we can do is work with those partners to help them understand where we need to go to benefit our populations. The next one is sufficient spawners. That's really important for us. That's about how we manage our fisheries, how we manage our harvest. Do we let enough fish back to support a viable population? And that's part of harvest management these days. Are the fish sufficiently fit to effectively use the habitat? Again, we're a huge part of that. How do our hatcheries impact the genetic integrity and quality of those fish returning so that those fish returning to natural spawning areas can use that habitat effectively? Our hatchery programs can have very adverse effects if we're not careful in how we operate them. Hatchery production is adequate to support productive fisheries. Again, that's our hatcheries, producing enough fish so that we can have those productive fisheries. We can always have opportunity, but if you catch one fish every month, then that's not much of an opportunity, for instance, for some people. So we need to make sure we worry about that. And finally, and most importantly, is the wild fish are returned to healthy and harvestable levels. This is the direct goal out of the recovery plan, and I think it's a very valuable goal, because if a population can reach a level where you can actually have directed harvest on that population, that natural origin population, that population is very healthy and will be viable for many generations to come. What is the ultimate success? When you really sit down and look at it, what's the ultimate success? That we have productive fisheries, but our natural populations, what's the ultimate success for them? They can spawn, they can rear, they can go out to the ocean, and they can come back and successfully spawn again as adults. That's what we're doing with part of this plan as our part. So I'm going to skip a couple of, I won't skip that slide. So here we have the hatchery reform and hatchery and fishery reform policy. This is really the cornerstone of the plan right here. This is what's really the plan is built upon, achieving the tenets of the policy that you adopted. And you look at the last line on that, implementation of hatchery reform, that's what this plan's about. How are we implementing hatchery reform in Southwest Washington to achieve? And there's a lot of expectations, including are we going to meet the standards for rearing practices set forth by the Hatchery and Scientific Review Group? Yes, that's part of that policy. That's part of what we're doing through this plan. I'll skip over a couple here because we got them out of order. And I want to go over the background and how we got to this point in the first place. Back in 2008, we had a couple of things coming at the same time. Simultaneously, we had a fairly major budget crisis with Mitchell Act, and our production levels could not sustain what they were producing based on the flatline budget we'd been receiving for over a decade. And we had to deal with that. At the same time, the HSRG had done a full review of all Columbia Basin hatchery and harvest programs, and they provided recommendations in terms of how to operate those programs, and they've provided standards in terms of guidance, in terms of how you should operate those programs. How many hatchery fish on the spawning grounds? How many natural fish do you use in your brood stocks? What's your harvest rates? Those kind of things. And they provided a lot of standards, especially with respect to interaction between hatchery fish and natural origin fish on the spawning grounds. And we adopted those and made those part of that. That was the first step. That was in 2008, early 2009. Shortly thereafter, the commission, you moved forward, and in November 2009 adopted the Hatchery and Fishery Reform Policy. That was really the catalyst to say, okay, we've developed a plan, we've worked on this plan, let's start implementing that plan. And that's when implementation began in full force, is in 2009, when this document, when your policy got adopted, we moved forward with the implementation. So what are some of the key actions we're going to do, the initial actions? First of all, as was talked about here earlier today, there are places where we reduced hatchery production. We just needed to do that because our hatchery production was large enough that it was negatively impacting the natural population, and in a way where that population was not going to survive over time. We had to move production to different areas, and we were extremely strategic about that. And this is one of the keys to this whole plan, is what we did was we looked at there's populations that are critical to recovery, and there's populations that have a lower level of importance to recovery. So we really focused our larger production programs in those areas where the populations are at a lower level for importance to recovery, and move programs away from those populations where they are critical for recovery. In doing so, we could keep 90 to 95% of the production we had at that time, but still protect those natural origin fish, especially those key populations that are really the linchpins to recovery of the ESU in the lower Columbia River. We improved access to natural origin adults. A lot of our facilities we had were blocking. We had fish ladders that weren't working. We had weirs across streams that prevented fish passage. We addressed a lot of those kind of things. We control hatchery fish on spawning grounds. I'll talk a little bit more about that. We had weirs that we put in some places. Other places we operate our dams. Other places, how we operate our hatcheries. We allow the natural fish to move upstream. We don't allow the wild fish to move upstream. We don't allow the hatchery fish to move upstream. And then finally, we had an intense public outreach, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. With that, I want to go up. Thank you. There we go. So we did, as I talked about, we did have an extensive hatchery outreach program. And we did this early on. And one of the key things we wanted to do with this was, first of all, we met with multiple constituent groups. Some of them actually asked us to come and talk about this plan so they understood it. The key messages we want to say to them was, what are we doing and why are we doing it? That was what we wanted to tell people. So when changes occurred, they understood. They may not have always agreed, and they may not have always said that's the best choice, but they understood why we did what we did. So we started out, first of all, we started out with a joint commission meeting in early 2008 and talked to both commissions about this particular topic. We then moved on and talked to the recovery board because we wanted them to understand what we were starting, the road we were starting down. We talked to staff in Region 5 and let them know what was happening so that when they started getting questions, they could answer this. And then we moved out to the public. We had four different meetings all the way from in Longview, Kathlamet, Washougal, and Westport. We covered multiple geographic areas. We met with trollers. We met with the legislators. And finally finished up with back at when we met with our advisors. We have a commercial and a recreational advisor groups in the lower Columbia. We met with them. And then finally we returned back to the recovery board and said, here's where we're at and here's where we're going. So with that, we completed that particular outreach. We turned our eyes and said, let's move towards implementation. How are we going to implement this plan? Let's start making this reality rather than just something on paper. To that end, we have a summary document that we've completed. And that summary document is really built in three phases. If you look at the introduction and the background, that part really gives you a context. Why are we doing this plan? What's the purpose? What's the impact of our hatcheries? It really gives you some background and some context for the decisions that are made. Chapter 7 and 8, those are the heart and soul of this plan. Those are what this is all about. Chapter 7, population by population. What's the status of that population? What's our hatchery programs? What actions are we taking to improve that population? Chapter 8, we have a metric called fitness. We measure the fitness of the populations before and after implementation of that plan. That fitness metric was developed by the HSRG and is out of their AHA model, which I'll talk about in just a moment. And what that does is really relates to productivity. The higher the fitness, the more productive that population. And we actually set fitness goals for ourselves that would achieve the productivity improvements called for in the recovery plan. And our measure of whether we're doing our job is, are we meeting those fitness goals or not? And that's really critical. And then finally, what cannot be overlooked is chapters 9 through 10.
and we look at the results of what happens. But more importantly, we have a monitoring and adaptive management plan. Monitoring, we have to, we go out, we find out, are the populations doing what we think? We implemented this based on modeling results. Are those real? So let's go out and look at the data, collect the data necessary to say that's real or not. And then how do we change our course? How do we move ourselves in a different direction to achieve that? And so what kind of hatch reactions are we actually taking to accomplish this? Number one, we're restricting hatchery fish on the natural origin, on the natural spawning grounds. And that the key to that is if you think back about those HSRG guidance, the populations are fit or those kind of things, this really speaks to how do we develop, improve the fitness of these populations. We're also reprogramming the hatchery program to reduce the risk. In some cases, we're using natural origin brood in our populations. Some cases, we're not. It just depends. This, again, gets to the fitness of the stock. How are we improving the productivity in the natural stock? By making the hatchery stock more compatible with the natural stock. So when they do move into the natural environment, they can survive there, not perish as they do right now. We're managing production levels to sustain commercial sport and tribal fisheries. That's hatchery production. That's about harvest and fisheries. We're upgrading our rearing facilities, and we're improving our infrastructure. And what those really focus on is when we talk about fish rearing, we want to raise healthier fish. We want quality smolts to go out and survive well. We just want healthier fish. And handling facilities, we want to handle the fish less. We have places where we actually take fish and throw them into trucks to get them into the truck to move them. Now we have that automated. We keep the fish in the water as much as time. We handle them as little as possible. So we really improve the quality of those spawning adults that we have to produce the fish. And there's a variety of tools we use to implement all of these things. And this is the first in a long line of tools that we use. The key to this is what's called an all-age analyzer. So that's the real, that's what AHA stands for. HGMPs are the hatchery genetic management plans that we are submitting to NOAA for their approval. And all these actions are included in those hatchery genetic management plans. The key to this modeling is this is how we measure our populations. This is how we evaluate it. So this modeling, we can put in a variety of data, and it can estimate some key metrics that tell we are doing a good job or not. It can estimate the number of hatchery fish on spawning grounds. It can estimate how many fish you're going to use in your broodstock, natural origin fish. It can say how many fish are going to be on the spawning grounds when we do these programs. And then it can say what is the fitness change in the population based on these different inputs. And the key to this is, as you've heard earlier, there is concern sometimes about how we use our data and what happens to that data. The key is going out and doing the monitoring and looking and saying, this is what we thought we were going to get. Is that what we really got? And that's what we're doing right now in the region, or we're trying to do. Another tool is integrated hatchery programs. These are programs where we take natural fish into the brood and rear them in the hatchery. And what the point of this is to make the genetics of the hatchery fish driven more by the natural environment than the hatchery environment. Because they're two very different environments, and they provide two different types of fish that survive in those two different environments. So we've got a variety of different integrated hatchery programs. Overall, there's 16 of them. There's 4 for fall Chinook, 5 for coho, 6 for winter steelhead, and another 1 for summer steelhead. You'll notice we don't have any for spring Chinook right now, and one of the big reasons is our main populations of spring Chinook in the Cowlitz and the Lewis haven't had access to their best habitat and the real habitat that's productive. So we don't have natural populations that we can start with to rebuild those. So we have to rebuild those populations, and then we can get into the integrated programs in those. And the key to integrated programs, like all these tools, is where do you use them? Where are they effective? Where are they not effective? So use the right tool in the right place. And that's what this plan does. It takes all the different tools, and Cindy will talk about some more, all the different tools and puts them together and says, for this population, this set of tools. And for this population, we got a different set of tools. And that's what this plan is about. And then finally, we have, for me, and then I'll pass it on to Cindy, we have weirs. We've established weirs in a variety of different streams. You see 6 of them there. that we have in different places. Three real reasons for putting weirs in streams: controlling hatchery fish on spawning grounds so we can remove hatchery fish from the spawning grounds at these weirs. Monitoring abundance, that's critically important, and it's not just the monitoring abundance of hatchery fish, it's natural fish. How many natural fish are getting back to those streams? This is how we can start testing the assumptions of our modeling. And finally, collecting broodstock for hatchery fish. This is a way to get our hands on natural origin fish and use them where we have our integrated programs. So, and one of the challenges with these weirs is flows. You'll notice we don't have weirs in every single stream, and that's because flows really impact whether we can operate a weir. In some cases, like the cowlitz, we're operating them year-round. In other cases, like the Washougal, we can only operate them on fall chinook. So with that, I will pass it on to Cindy and let her complete the presentation.
Probably, I feel like I don't have a whole lot more to say because Pat kind of stole half of what I was going to say, but we'll go through anyway. Can you push the button for me?
Yes, I'm sorry.
So one of the other tools is the harvest actions, and so how are we using harvest? So we're trying to increase the harvest of hatchery fish. One of the ways that we're doing that is with marked selective fisheries. We're also managing to support recovery of natural populations, so that's meeting our ESA limits. And then we also are trying to maintain or establish wild steelhead gene banks or wild salmonid management zones. One of the actions that we recently took to increase harvest of hatchery fish in the lower Columbia was increase the daily limit on steelhead to 3 fish. We also implemented a mandatory retention requirement for keeping hatchery steelhead in the lower Columbia. And that's kind of has not received as much enthusiasm from some of the public as we would have liked. But the next one is marked selective fisheries. Go down.
Okay.
And we've implemented a lot of marked selective fisheries. For coho and steelhead, most of those fisheries have been marked selective for many years in most fisheries. Not all, but most. Spring chinook are all marked selective. I'm talking non-tribal below Bonneville Dam. For fall chinook, we have some limited marked selective fisheries. There's been a couple weeks in the ocean fisheries that have been marked selective on chinook. Same thing in the lower Columbia, several weeks. But for the most part, all of our tributaries are marked selective. And then there's been some limited marked selective in the commercial fishery with using seines. The next slide is wild stock management zones. And this is included in your hatchery and fishery reform policy. Steelhead gene banks have been designated, and working on the wild salmon management zones as the next step. The fish program wanted to start this focus on for these wild management zones with steelhead. So the next slide shows a little bit of where we have some wild zones in place, and some of these benefit multiple species. You can see that we've got 13 wild management zones currently, and 19 populations benefit. You can see the numbers there. We do have some zones benefit multiple species, and we have one basin, the East Fork Lewis, that has no hatchery fish of any kind being released in there. Talking about steelhead gene banks, this is also included in the statewide steelhead management plan, and we've embarked on a process in the lower Columbia to adopt steelhead gene banks. And we just, so in March of 2014, we established 3 wild steelhead gene banks, and then we just finished our last one. The news release came out, I think, on Wednesday for the lower Columbia, the coastal range. So that was our final steelhead gene bank. So Pat talked a little bit about monitoring and evaluation. It is a key aspect of this plan implementation. We've developed a much more comprehensive monitoring and evaluation program in the region in the last some number of years. We're getting a lot more information than we used to have. We need this to monitor, as Pat said, the actions, document our results, track the trajectory, and then report on our standards. But more importantly, it's also going to help us determine what the next step is. So we've got assumptions in some of the models. This is our method. This is how we're going to validate those assumptions. We're focusing on the viable salmonid population parameters, VSP, abundance, spatial distribution, productivity, and diversity. And so we're getting more of this information. We're getting a lot of information that we didn't have in the past. For instance, fall Chinook in the lower Columbia were mass marked, and we're now, because of that, and it hasn't been that many years ago, we're able to tell visually hatchery and wild fish apart, which also allows us to have those marked selective fisheries. So that's where we are with monitoring and evaluation. Adaptive management. I just want to say I was at the January Commission meeting, and I heard some conversations between commissioners and some of the public about adaptive management. And I was sitting in the audience and thinking, this is one of my favorite phrases. And it's so key to this plan because of what we just talked about, because we've got to truth up with our monitoring what our assumptions are for these programs and whether we're going to meet the objectives. And if we don't, we're going to have to change courses. And so it's very key. So with monitoring results, it'll help us shape our future actions. And the other key part is that many of these actions that we're talking about are in their initial stages. And so it's going to take some time to see what the results are going to be. So we've got to have the monitoring and the adaptive management to make those adjustments. And I think, I guess another key part in my mind is that we're trying to set things up so that we don't go too far down a pathway that doesn't allow us to change directions. So, for instance, completely closing a hatchery that maybe we would want to, we should not have done that. So we're trying to be cognizant of those kinds of things. So there's several key things in play. Basically, you know, how's the hatchery reform actions working? Increased population monitoring is increased knowledge, and as we gain that, then we're going to adjust. The role of fisheries is another key part in there, in the lower Columbia, implementing seine fisheries, and how is that going to work? And then I didn't put budgets on here either, but that's another key piece for us, and it kind of leads into the next slide, which is some of the challenges, and you know, funding is on the list. The hatcheries in the lower Columbia are all funded by Mitchell Act funds, with the exception of the two PUD hatcheries on the Cowlitz and Lewis, and those are funded by those PUDs. But the rest are Mitchell Act funds, and Pat alluded to, we've been on flat funding for decades or reduced funding. And, you know, you have failing hatchery infrastructure, there's repairs needed, just lots of stuff. So funding is a key challenge for us. Monitoring and evaluation, we do get some Mitchell Act funding to help us do our monitoring, but if we don't have the monitoring, we're not going to know what direction, if we're going in the right direction or not. So that is also key. Increasing effectiveness of our selective fisheries, especially the marked selective fisheries, achieving necessary hydro and habitat improvements as well. And that kind of leads into the next slide. And Pat talked about this really, which is the other H's. The hydro piece is critical to reintroduction efforts, and that's primarily in the Lewis and Cowlitz. Huge basins, big efforts going on in those two areas. And then in the habitat arena, again, habitat protection and improvement is the cornerstone of the recovery plan. And, you know, this little graph on this slide shows that the benefit that you can, if you just have without the habitat improvements, you're going to get, you know, some increase in that bar, but you put the habitat improvements in there and you're basically doubling. But this is an area that we don't have a lot of authority in, and there's a lot of community involvement. And the other part of the habitat piece is that it's not something that you can see immediate results on, unlike harvest and hatcheries. You can close a fishery, you can change production in hatchery. People see immediate effects of that. And in the hydro and habitat, you can't see that. And so people sometimes get impatient and say, we need to move faster. But those are key pieces that have to be involved in this process for us to be successful. So we've got this draft plan. We put it out for public review and public comment. And we did get a considerable number of comments from agencies and individuals. And, you know, you can look at the list. We've got some very key partners in the public comments that we received. What we're doing is incorporating many of those comments into the document. We're making changes as they recommended. But most of the comments were supportive of our efforts and the outcomes. There were some concerns about, you know, progress to date and predicted outcomes, and we share those concerns about predicted outcomes. Thus, we need to continue the monitoring. I think one thing we need to remember is that we've been dealing with decades of impacts from hatcheries on natural fish, and it's not going to turn around in a day or a year. It's going to take a lot of effort across a lot of H's to get the job done. So, summary of where are we? So this is a good path to success, we believe. And it utilizes the hatcheries to address challenges. It ultimately should result in increased population productivity and natural origin abundance. It should achieve the biological impact reduction targets that are set forth in the recovery plan. But again, we have to have the other H's come to the table. And adequate funding is necessary to implement this plan. And that's all we have. If you have any questions.
Yes, Mr. Grable.
Pat, I'm glad to see you're back in Region 5. That's terrific. Yeah, way back when the endorsement board was originally formed is when you brought the presentation. So that goes back a couple of years. So it's great to see you back
in
a very vital region of the Columbia River. Both of you spoke to the importance of monitoring as being a critical element. I mean, how do you measure success? How do you respond with adaptive management mid-season, for example? In my view, monitoring is lacking within your region. In my experience on the endorsement board, there was some funding that provided monitoring on a rotating basis. You remember that, Cindy?
Mm-hmm.
We do this one this year, this one the next year. I think at the most recent endorsement board meeting, some funding was provided for McNary Dam down that covered a certain stretch. However, I still contend that there are big gaps in the monitoring in Region 5. Fairly recently, we dodged a bullet on escapement to the Snake River in a very important beam run steelhead because of I think the challenges of monitoring. I would hope that there's an analysis of the needed monitoring within that region. It would be interesting to see where you believe monitoring is adequate and perhaps where you feel there are gaps. I'd be interested in seeing that because, as you say, this requires funding. You know, that's a difficult challenge, Cindy, as you know. And also, you know, the endorsement board only received a one-year extension. And Region 5, I believe, could benefit a lot from the continued existence of the endorsement board to fund these gaps in your monitoring. So that, from what I see, is one of the challenges within that region for this program, a very important program that you're demonstrating very good success with to really succeed, is the value of your ability to monitor, the value of your monitoring information. That's just a comment.
If I could follow up on the steelhead and the endorsement board. So as a result of what you talked about potentially happening last summer, the other regional program managers in Regions 1, 2, 3, and 5, we've had some discussions about how to address that. And we do have a plan, and we're going to provide a draft plan to the endorsement board in August about how we would like to try to get at some monitoring of the main stem Columbia, specifically focused on steelhead, and then move into the Snake River. So we do think that the endorsement board funds are the avenue for that, and we're going to pursue that. In terms of the regional monitoring needs, I believe there's a section in the document that talks about monitoring and what we're doing, but I'm not sure, does it have monitoring needs in this conservation plan?
So the conservation plan itself doesn't call out how much monitoring we need or what the dollars for the monitoring needs are. We've made significant progress in Region 5 in the last 5 years. 5 years ago, we couldn't estimate coho abundance in any of our streams. Now we can do it in all of our streams. 5 years ago, we couldn't estimate number of hatchery origin fish on spawning grounds for fall Chinook. We can do that now. We're working on an integration study for steelhead to find out how much steelhead are impacting our natural populations. So we are making progress, but you're right. There's two real challenges to monitoring in Region 5. First of all, maintaining what we have. We live off Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Funds is a large part of what survives us. If that budget goes down, which is consistently a question, then we start losing significant monitoring. And even with the monitoring improvements, there is more to be done. And we have put together a proposal that's moving forward, or you know, that's at least been discussed within the fish program in terms of what it would take to really do the monitoring needs we need to do. Right now, we're doing a fairly good job on abundance. We're doing a decent job on hatchery fish on spawning grounds, but we're not making a lot of progress, and we're doing a decent job on spatial diversity. But productivity, our spatial structure, but productivity and diversity, we're not doing a very good job on monitoring those particular VSP characteristics. So, and we need to step up and do that to give us the full breadth of monitoring. So there is progress that needs to be made. Thank you very much for recognizing that.
A couple of questions. Cindy, I think it was you that mentioned that the hatcheries have had flat funding for decades. I think the term decades was used. How has that, it seems to me that when you have flat funding, that's going to affect production. To what extent has flat funding affected production at the hatcheries and the CFS hatcheries?
So, you know, Pat talked about back in 2008 with some Mitchell Act budget cuts in the beginning, starting that process. And so we have, I can't tell you the total, you know, I can't tell you right now the trend line of reductions over time in hatchery production. We've tried to maintain or switch production to other areas if we could, but we have lost overall production due to budget cuts or due to that flat funding. Recently, we lost some coho production out of the Kalama, 300 or 600,000. And then there was another loss just in the recent couple of years due to budgets. So I don't have that entire package built, you know, that shows you can, you know, I could do that easily, shows the change in production. I'm trying to think off the top if there's been other ramifications of the funding. The flat funding, part of it is just things don't get fixed either. And then maybe they get broke. I don't know what we're going to do about the flood that we had at Fowler Creek. That's a good example of a big cost, unless we get some drought money or something. Do you want to add
Well, and I think a really good example of what flat funding does is a locum and hatchery. One of the reasons we had to close locum and hatchery when we did was we had a $15 to $20 million bill to bring that thing up to code to make it work and make it function effectively. That's the result of long-term flat funding and investing. WDFW, to their credit, over the years invested money and said we're going to keep producing fish. Even if we have a raceway that leaks a little bit, we'll use some duct tape. We'll go MacGyver and figure out how to fix all these facilities so that we can keep them running. And at some point, that comes and catches up with you. So I think a locum and hatchery is an excellent example of the overall impact of flat funding. When you think about that, that's significant production. That was several million Chinook. That was hundreds of thousands of coho and then tens of thousands of steelhead. So that's a significant production, and that's a whole basin that's lost its production due to that flat funding. That's an example. The other thing I think Cindy talked about was starting 2008. We can't forget that there was a fairly significant budget cut back in the 90s when we significantly reduced all our steelhead programs because at that point Mitchell Act funding had been flat funded and we didn't have the funds to continue to operate all our facilities. So steelhead was the one that was reduced the first time. So it is a long track record.
The concern is out there. The concern is out there not only with us but with our co-managers throughout the system. And if you look at the percentage of the fish that are harvested in places like Puget Sound and especially the Columbia River, we're talking about numbers. I'm sure they're not correct at this point, but numbers like 80%, 70%, 80% of the returning fish in some areas are hatchery fish. That's got to be of concern here. How do we get around that? And I think you've answered it. I have another question for you. Thank you for that answer. That was the answer I knew you were going to give me.
So. Okay. You and I aren't on the same wavelength, huh?
Yeah. Here's another one for you. To what extent are the tribes, who are co-managers, involved in the CFS hatchery reform process? What is their role?
So this plan is focused on below Bonneville.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cowlitz tribe is our primary co-manager in that region.
But there are upriver tribes also that have fish that transit the lower Columbia River that we're harvesting, and there may be strays from some of those populations into the lower Columbia River tributaries.
So the populations or the fish that we're talking about primarily stay below Bonneville Dam, but they do support ocean fisheries majorly. That's a word. Can you ask your question again? I'm sorry, Commissioner.
To what extent are they participating? And I'm thinking of marking hatchery fish, for example.
So programs above Bonneville Dam are outside this conservation sustainable fisheries plan. This plan is focused below Bonneville only. Now, to get at your question, we're trying to get as many fish mass marked above Bonneville Dam as possible. I think our biggest one that's out there still is Priest Rapids Hatchery, which is a huge producer of upriver brights. But the federal hatcheries in the Bonneville Pool area, I'm thinking Little White Salmon, Carson, they're mass marking their fish. I believe most of the fish in the Upper Columbia are mass marked. The Snake River, for the most part, they're mass marked. So there's a tribal hatchery on the Clearwater, and I don't know what the status of their fall Chinook marking levels are. But for the most part, the hatcheries are mass marking most of the fish. If you ultimately jump to the next level of mark rates in fisheries, and why, and which is what our constituents are seeing, and why it's difficult to have mark selective fisheries when you have a low mark rate. Priest Rapids Hatchery again is a big piece of that, but I mean the Upriver Bright population is mostly wild, spawning on Hanford Reach, so there's no way to mass mark those. Another wild population in the Deschutes, and then there's another wild population, obviously in the Snake, and those are getting bigger and bigger every year. Those aren't mass marked, and then the Yakima has a wild population, so that's part of that whole picture as well. I'm not as up to speed on all of the marking strategy up there. I know that. Priest Rapids is a major challenge, but I believe most of the fed hatcheries are mass marking.
And so when you think about that too, you think about USV Oregon, and this is really a different vehicle than USV Oregon, because USV Oregon really guides a lot of what happens up there, and that's where we have to make those kind of adjustments, is through USV Oregon. When you look at this, the real interesting part is they impact our plan, as you pointed out, more than we impact their plan. And so that's where the monitoring of spawning grounds and the ratio of hatchery fish on spawning grounds is key, to see how their programs are impacting our programs so that we can try to adjust for that. The other way that it really impacts it is successive implementation of alternative gear. Because without that high mark rate on those bright fall Chinook from some of those hatchery fish programs that aren't being marked, your alternate gear becomes less successful, because they can't retain enough fish to make that feasibly viable, economically viable. So it's more of them impacting us, and how do we adjust our program and how we adjust our plan, than us being able to impact them. And the way we try to do that is through USV Oregon. One of the things we did do to make sure that the tribes were not going to get concerned about the choices we were making down here, because we knew these would be a little bit more controversial for them, the choices we're making, we made sure we achieved all our USV Oregon commitments through this plan. So there's no way they can come forward and say, well, you're not providing us the fish you promised to provide us under USV Oregon. So we have maintained those commitments.
Thank you.
Thanks for that wonderful presentation. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking about a presentation that I think that Bill Twight did maybe 4 or 5 years ago on the backdrop to this whole conversation is the recovery plan for listed stocks. And I think he told us it was a 75-year timeline for recovery of some of the listed stocks. So how does what we're doing here that you're discussing play into that bigger context of the path towards delisting eventually?
I'll start, and I know Pat will not be able to, but so we want to be on a trajectory that's going uphill, and we think this will do that. Again, this is focused on hatcheries and harvest. Mm-hmm. So we think this plan will get us moving in the right direction. Again, you got to go back to the other H's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about monitoring, and that we're learning more and we know more, and one of the things that we're learning is that we've got more wild natural coho and wild natural steelhead than we thought in some of these tributaries. And there's also some thought that we might be fully seeded for those populations in some or most of our tributaries. So how do you increase, how do you get to recovery goals if that's where you're at? Well, you've got to go to the habitat. You've got to open up more opportunity or repair the habitat and provide more space. So I think that's where, bottom line on your question was, we're just moving in that upward trend.
And you're correct. There is a longer time frame. Yes, I can't stop myself. There is a longer time frame from the recovery plan. It's actually a 50-year time frame that they look at. They actually have benchmarks every 12 years or so to see how progress is going. And when they put that together, they looked at the different H's, and the hatchery and harvest, they front-loaded them. So the goal for the hatchery and harvest is to initially take bigger reductions, because they have more immediate effects. If you don't harvest wild fish, you get more fish on the spawning grounds. If you improve genetics, you get healthier fish on the spawn. So that's an immediate reaction. So let's front load those actions. And then it takes, as Andy Appleby used to tell me, it takes 100 years to grow a 100-year-old tree. And you can't change that process. So it takes time to do the habitat. So you start the habitat now, you start seeing its effects. And when you see the effects of habitat start combining with your hatcheries, then all of a sudden you can start modifying your hatchery programs, increase your harvest rates, those kind of things, because now your populations, your natural populations, are more able to sustain higher harvest rates or higher hatchery programs or those kind of things, because there's the natural stability, the environment for them to succeed in, plus they're genetically fit to do that. So that's how that plan was actually put together. So,
Mr. Holstein. Thank you, Chair. As a guy living 300 plus miles from the ocean, when you guys start talking habitat, you catch my ear very quickly. We had the first red mottled watershed in the state of Washington, in the Soton Creek. And the one thing, and we have dealt with fish issues, habitat issues, from the mouth to the head waters of it. And this all started in the very early 90s. So when we went and talked to fish biologists about we were wanting to do restoration work, they thought we were nuts, first of all. And then their approach was really positive. Anything you guys are willing to do, we're going to support you 100%. And you guys being in leadership and management, from time to time, you got to go back to the basics and just remind staff that when you're talking habitat issues, anything you can do, a private landowner can do that is positive for fish, be supportive thereof. And there again, it never became a millstone around your neck to do fish habitat work. And it was a tough sell at the beginning, and then all of a sudden when everybody learned, in every project we did, we always structured it so that it was a win-win, that the habitat was going to win and that the landowners were going to come out ahead and it wasn't going to come back and haunt them. So I guess it's just back to basics. Remember and remind staff when you're approaching these. I'm a huge private property advocate. So, yes, if you can make it a win-win and just try and remember to remind staff that that's what we're looking for. So thank you.
Thank you both. Very informative, per usual. And we're, if